Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have back as my guest Dr. David Lowe. We're going to be discussing today growing atheist orientation in modern society, and really what that means in terms of ethics, morals, and the direction that especially the Western world has taken. Thanks, Dr. Lowe, for joining us. Where are you calling in from today?
I'm calling in from Flourtown, Pennsylvania, just north of Philadelphia. Yeah, it's great to be here.
Great. Well, you want to give the listening audience a little bit of your background and how you became interested in the study of religion, spirituality, consciousness?
Yeah, sure. Basically, in college, I had my big initiation into transcendental meditation. I was predisposed somehow inwardly to have these incredible experiences, which led me later on to an initiation into a major guru path in yoga. And I was just blasted wide open, began having dreams connected with various spiritual masters and angels, you could say. Dreams began directing my life, inner messages connected with all this. And I've always been a heavy-duty seeker, overcoming a lot of personal obstacles, and just experiencing this extraordinary sense of transcendence connected with studying religion, doing meditation, going to India, being with teachers and so forth, but mostly having these incredible inner experiences of breakthrough and of, you know, personal transformation in terms of having my life directed here and there by dreams extraordinarily, and sometimes by spiritual masters in real life. Yeah, it's been quite a journey.
Yeah, but it is. That's great. So we've done a number of shows, and they're available on the archives, which is plasticos.com under Resources and Radio. We've discussed different major religions and how fundamentalism in the religions has affected society, and you know, other topics. Why don't you mention the book that you wrote on spiritual principles?
Yeah, Universal Spiritual Philosophy and Practice. What this book is a textbook written in a fun, easy way to read. The material itself is often difficult, but it's written in a very compelling way, people tell me, with lots of pictures and word balloons. It really is, I mean, what are the common philosophical dimensions which all the practices and all the religions, the pagan traditions, the mystery schools, the secular agnostic groups even, what do they all have in common? And how can you experience that? Okay, this is what the book lets you know. All those things fit into a big jigsaw puzzle. So you get a better sense of your own interest and orientation in spirituality. And more important than that, a greater experience of the underlying truth that all spiritualities come out of. Underneath all the wars and arguments, the political nonsense, the cults and blind allies and so forth, transcending your culture, whatever language you speak, there is a deeper reality. And this book takes you there. So it's written for folks who are sick of religion and who are looking for answers at like a deeper level than language and culture. Yeah.
So, you know, I often recommend this book. You know, people ask me, you know, all the time if there was one book that I would recommend in order for somebody to get an overview of spirituality. And I recommend this book because it's the best one I've seen in a while, so I just wanted to let people know that. It's a good overview. It's written in language that people can relate to, not real. You know, some of the spiritual books are, you got to spend about an hour on each chapter just to understand them, and, you know, it can get very heavy, and yours isn't. Yours is well written.
Okay. Well, thank you for that plug. And folks, if you want a good reference, this is the book to have. It's a lot of fun. Pictures, word balloons. All under 200 pages. It's not
right, exactly. It's not a great big volume. It's hard to read. Now, you also do dream work. We've done a couple of shows on dreams and dream interpretation. And why don't you tell them about your dream work sessions that you offer, so that they, and also your website before we get into this, so maybe they can go to your website and see what's on there.
David Lowe, L-O-W, no E on the end of the name, David Lowe, L-O-W, MSPhD.com. Yeah, my own spirituality predisposed me involuntarily to to dream a great deal. And I'm primarily a dream worker for nighttime dreams. I do courses, workshops on dreams, individual consultation concerning the most likely meaning of a given dream or a group of dreams, which someone may have. So, yeah, basically, only the dreamer can really know what a dream means, because only the dreamer really knows his or her life circumstances the best. In the meantime, though, I find that people are often way off in their own interpretation due to mistaken literalism, as Jeremy Taylor calls it. You don't want to take the literally. God or the dream sources, I like to call it, doesn't spoon feed us anything. So if you do a session with me, what will happen is I want three pieces of, so we all have dream sight, as I like to call it. Some people have special gifts like clairvoyance and so forth, but everybody has dream sight. It's our own natural faculty for communicating with higher reality. We've all got it. If you do a session with me, I'll ask for three pieces of information. One, basic demographics, your sort of name, interest, age, occupation, things like that, family configuration, who's alive, who's dead, internal problems and issues, what your mind's dwelling on, external things going on in your life, and, of course, the dream itself in as much detail as you can give it to me. Ideally in writing ahead of time so I can see everything and look at it, but I can do it over the phone on the fly, although it won't be as effective. So, yeah, I do readings, you could say, but it's really more of an analytical process between myself with the client. We work out what the most likely possible meaning of the dream is. Yeah.
That sounds great. So one of the things that I wanted to tell a little bit about my history and how I was never an atheist, because I was always really involved in science and animals and nature, and I could never really believe that there wasn't, you know, some sort of a creator. But I was what I would say agnostic, and
sure.
That continued until my freshman year in college. So I was at Johns Hopkins, and I was laying on the bed taking a nap, and I woke up, and there was golden light throughout the room, and standing above me a little bit to the back was a 7 or 8 foot male warrior guardian angel with this energy that was the last time I could be agnostic, because, you know, you just can't see an angel and then believe that the other realms do not exist. And it really is a problem of perception. If I had not had that perceptual reality shift, I don't think I would have shifted so quickly into spirituality. And I'm sure you have similar stories with your own awakenings and experiences. Spirituality is best experienced, not just read about. I mean, when you experience it, there's no doubt in your mind that this is real.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is that deeper dimension, and people need to unlearn a lot of stuff. I think, you know, atheism is growing in prevalence and has been for some time, and I think that's good. I think a lot of things basically have to break down, including our old beliefs, religious beliefs, which keep us stuck in old ways of doing and thinking, which are often resulting in destructive trends of thinking, destructive policies around the environment, and so forth. The religion, all the ancient Abrahamic religions, define themselves against each other. They each think they're the best on the Orthodox level. And these are thoughts that we've got to get over. These tribal ways of thinking have got to go. Yeah. As those
well, they're responsible for a lot of the wars, that's for sure, and a lot of the conflicts.
The literal thinkers in all the religions are the ones responsible for all of the wars and conflicts, absolutely. So, yeah, I think humanity is becoming more intelligent. For all the issues that they have, pretty much all atheists do understand that Sunday school teachings are meant for children, not for adults. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
They may not believe that a common God exists, but they do realize that superficial ideas of God are of cultural origin. So many of them are smarter than folks in the churches, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. So what would you say? You say that is it more common to have kind of the atheist, agnostic, and then an experience that leads you into spirituality? Or is it more common to have like a fundamentalist viewpoint either shift into atheism or into spirituality? I mean, how do you think that goes with most people that you've talked to?
The people I've talked to in terms of students in universities, they typically grow out of a fundamentalist background most of the time, I find. I've talked to.
Do they go towards spirituality, though, or do they go toward atheism?
Well, they first go towards atheism, absolutely.
Okay.
What I try to make them aware of is that they have an inherent spirituality of their own. We're all born with transcendent dimension, this core idealism, I call it. So for me, the term atheist is kind of a misnomer. We all have a spirituality, okay? And I think people drift from fundamentalism into atheism, and then later they discover a deeper spirituality, which very often is not religious at all. Okay, so this transcendent dimension, this transcendent dimension that we're all born with, gets associated with different things as we grow up. For some people, that isn't primarily their religion.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, science or friends and family is probably the biggest thing. It could be science, technology, it could be nature, it could be drug use, philosophy, art, literature. Mm-hmm. Whatever your primary association with that transcendent dimension is, as you grow up with, whatever you're initially associate with the most, that tends to be what your spirituality focuses around. It doesn't necessarily involve the idea of God. So there are other kinds of spiritualities aside from the religious one, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people are, what I was saying about myself, studying biology, studying microbiology, biochemistry, just life itself. I mean, just the study of how life was so complex and so, you know, structure and form were so related, and the beauty of microscopic life and all of the different fractal patterns in nature. And, you know, you get to the point where even if you don't believe in God, you know that there's some creative force there that is much more intelligent than any human could be.
Yeah, and I mean,
it's a logical thing, really. It's like this could not have just happened randomly.
It's a logical thing because, you know, the super big and the super small lead you to the same fundamental profound mystery.
Astronomers looking out at the galaxy would have a similar, you know, the patterns of the galaxies and everything would have a similar effect. It just is very humbling, you know. You're a little overwhelmed by it, and you can't say that just happened by chance.
Right. What happens at both ends of the scale, both the super big and the super small, you encounter what they call the observer effect. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
If whether it's through the most powerful microscope ever, or whether it's through the biggest telescope ever, you reach a point at which the process of observing the phenomenon begins to affect the phenomenon itself.
Mm-hmm.
You come back to the astounding realization that it's all you. That extraordinary, profound, radical truth that you know, we are it. You know, it's like.
Mm-hmm.
The amazing thing is that like we all share a universe. That's the extraordinary thing, you know. But just the notion that you know we are each God, completely, totally, and absolutely. However crazy and revolutionary, and arrogant, and insane that seems, that's the truth. That's the good news, you know. And you encounter when you really study, you know, modern physics in the context of the very big or the very small.
Yeah, I think Rumi said, you are not a drop in the ocean. You are the ocean in a drop.
Right. And you're the pen in the hand. You are the pen in the hand of God.
Right, right.
Involuntarily.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Yeah, so there, what I would love to see, atheists, most atheists haven't really thought about the issue at all about God, because they subscribe their atheism in very, very superficial ways. And of course God's mm-hmm. going to be inconsistent and contradictory between the religions. There are different cultures. Of course there are different teachings, because all these founding figures had different psychological and personal mm-hmm. inclinations. And of course God's going to be too anthropomorphic, because, mm-hmm. The very first thing that we all associate that transcendent dimension with as we grow up is the human form. Sigmund Freud.
So you've got Father, the Father God with a white beard up in the sky.
Right.
Which, and atheists are rejecting that, because that just is absurd,
Exactly.
So that's the first thing you do, is reject that image.
Right. I mean, I don't believe Sigmund Freud at all, but he was, on the orthodox sociological level, he was one of the most brilliant thinkers of the 20th century. His patriarchal mm-hmm. theory of atheism is probably the best theory of atheism out there. This is the notion that, we were 6 months, 1 year old, looking up mm-hmm. into our parents' eyes at these,
right.
6 months old, looking up at our parents, these mythically giant figures
mm-hmm.
in our brain at age 6 months, and later on, 30 years later, we project that out into the universe as a father figure.
Right, yeah.
That,
because you're pretty helpless. At 6 months, you're pretty helpless. That's your whole world. I mean, and, the Old Testament gods, which were probably more Palladian gods or, lesser gods, they weren't God, had all of the characteristics of, jealousy and favoritism and punishment and all of these things, which you generally would contribute to a parent. A parent acts more like that than the New Testament God,
Well, this is one of the infuriating things about Orthodox religion, The notion that, you can't have it, frontline scripture needs to be able to be understood by everybody at some level, including children. And mm-hmm. that means that God has to be very clear, very obvious, And so in the Old Testament, God is this big boss military commander type, okay?
Right.
And so he's very, very definite and powerful. And there's nothing really indefinite about it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But really, you, that has to be thrown out. That has to be thrown out if we're ever going to,
right.
if we're ever going to think at more deeper, more profound levels. We have to realize that that's just one set of cultural influences. The Taoist mm-hmm. Confucian deity, Shangti, is another set of cultural influences.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And, we don't know. There's less certainty amongst, there isn't a lot of certainty among scholars as to what Jesus actually taught, mm-hmm. at least not Orthodox scholars. Okay.
Right.
But we certainly, the way he's portrayed by the church fathers in the Bible, he worshipped a god seemingly primarily apart from himself, which, of course, mm-hmm. wasn't true at all, but they wanted to portray him that way.
Right, so, yeah.
You have a very, very devotional aspect to Christ being portrayed in the Bible. Mm-hmm. He may well have been a lot more subtle and profound and philosophical than devotional mm-hmm. in his teaching. But the way he's portrayed in the Bible, of course, is the way the church fathers chose to portray him.
Yeah. And I just have a feeling that Jesus was never into being a martyr either. I mean, I think that was almost a misstep for him, rather. I mean, it wasn't that the church fathers are saying, he died for your sins and this, that, and the other. But I just have a feeling that isn't true. I have a feeling that he got crosswise with some political things that led him to be strung up, rather than, that was the plan. It's not necessarily what's in, what was reported hundreds of years after his death.
Yeah, you're right. It's and also, there's a tendency to think that these great philosophers who did write up, God is anthropomorphic most of the time for obvious reasons, because as mm-hmm. we grow up, the first thing that we associate that transcendent dimension with is the human form, as I've said. So
right. yeah.
inevitably associate, to the extent that we have, to the extent that we are sympathetic with the notion of perfection, with God, we associate that with human beings as they grow up, naturally. But people don't realize, you know, there are these great philosophers who wrote up very technical descriptions of the formless absolute, the effulgent void, you know. So God is not always a person. So certain human beings have always been the source of religion and spiritual teaching. Mm-hmm. But even, I think, every non-human source was always channeled through or represented by a human source, at least in medium ancient history.
Right.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yes.
Yeah, you really have to start with the New Testament if you want to understand, the non-anthropomorphic God. And you're right, we don't know what Jesus taught. We don't. A lot of it was lost. He taught in ancient Aramaic, and the translations into English, I've got a plaque on my wall, the Beatitudes translated directly from Aramaic into English are totally different than what's in the Bible.
Sure.
Completely different meanings. It's incredible.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can't go through two or three languages and then come up with anything that is the same meaning.
Yeah, yeah. I think also the profound reasons that people have for being atheistic are really worth fathoming and understanding.
Mm-hmm.
I think the existence of so-called evil and the so-called devil, mm-hmm. which I think is a very useful idea, but does not ultimately have any reality.
Mm-hmm.
For me, anyway. It's interesting. There are people who believe in good versus evil with a God involved on the good side. There are people who believe in good versus evil with no God anywhere.
Right, yeah.
With no concept of enlightenment anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Overall, I think it is more difficult for atheists because they have to construct their own basis for the existence of good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be tenuous if there isn't a sense of something being there.
Yeah. Well, you probably heard the theory that, you know, in the third dimension, we're in the dimension of polarities. You know, not necessarily in the fifth, but in the third, it's polarities. So
right.
Down here, we're kind of dumbed down, and we have what we call free will, which means we can choose to do stupid stuff, and we often do. So, and then we get the consequences of that, and then maybe the next time the choice comes around, maybe we won't be so stupid. Or maybe we'll just continue to be stupid, you know. It's like we've got all this free will down here. In the higher dimensions, what we're taught is that the beings in the higher dimensions don't really have free will. They have free will, but they always choose to do what's best for the whole. So therefore, they choose not to suffer. And so free will is really something that you're going to have in the third dimension, but not necessarily in the higher dimensions. But when you're in an area of polarity, you're going to have good and evil. And good and evil is nothing more than the results of different choices, really. I mean, in your own life. So,
yeah.
Especially if karma exists and you're actually just re-experiencing whatever you put out, it's coming back to you, then maybe you'll learn not to, you know, not to be so negative and nasty and vengeful and, you know, all the negative emotions. And, you know, the dance between bullies and people who are bullied.
Sure.
You know, it's a dance. It's a dance. And Buddha says you need the middle road. You know, you don't need to be a bully and you don't need to be bullied. You know, you need to be the middle road. You need to have compassion for everybody and not be a victim or a victimizer. And I think that's what we do here. We learn the higher spiritually evolved people aren't bullied, you know, because they're not bullies. You know, they got rid of that in previous lives. So,
right.
You know, they're walking the middle path. So the middle path is between the two polarities.
Yeah. So speaking of free will, you know, we're all human. We all interact with the great mystery. For most people, it may still be only subconscious, but we all interact with it. The less profoundly we interact with it, the more our lives are run by mental routines and programs, which shield us from
mm-hmm.
thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, you know, I did my dissertation on Spinoza. And Spinoza, this is like back in like the early 17th century. He thought that there was no such thing as free will. Okay, mm-hmm. That is how thoroughly convinced he was that we are programmed by all our routines and ideas and robotic responses, which all too many of us learned growing up. And breaking out of that, you know, finding that there is a sort of divine harmony that everything works according to. You can be a prostitute, you can be a bartender, you can be a car repo man. There mm-hmm. is a right way to do everything, you know. And once you when you reach enlightenment, you click into this perfect harmony, which is a paradoxical expression of both free will and determinism at the same time, as mm-hmm. I understand it. And so, but now you're saying that in the higher dimensions, these beings do have choices, even though there's no free will. Am I right?
Well, I mean, free will always exists. It's just that if you are totally one with the mind of God, right. Are you likely to make the wrong choice?
Yeah, that's a paradox.
I mean, the choice that leads to suffering rather than to, you know, bliss.
You can make a choice which leads to suffering if, in the longer run, it's meant to help other people see a better path for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, Rumi, again, that wonderful expression,
yeah.
Hand in the hand of God. So
right.
You can be a parent, you can be a corporate boss, you can be whatever your role is. You can do something which is seemingly, well, exercising tough love, seemingly violent, seemingly difficult,
mm-hmm. right.
Having the outcome later on of like producing more harmony for mm-hmm. those listening and for those seeing what you're doing.
But the higher dimensions are different, okay? Number one, as you go up dimensionally, what we're taught is that they have less physical laws, okay? So the fifth dimension doesn't have as many physics laws as we do at this dimension. So at the higher levels, life is probably more simplified. You know, it's not as complex.
Sure.
And, you know, although you have choices, and, you know, you can do this or do that. And then my understanding is that the higher dimensions, like if you think about being somewhere, you're there.
Yeah.
Instantaneously, okay?
Right.
Or if you, you know, want to create something, it doesn't take, you know, 10 years to build a pyramid.
Right.
You know, you can build it much quicker, okay? So you see, the laws are different. So I think...
Well, that reminds me of what you're saying about last uh-huh. time I think we talked about lucid dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
One thing which everybody learns who tries to lucid dream it and who manages to do it really well, and what I teach people about dreams is, you know, dreams are best understood as a state in which we are actually half formed.
Mm-hmm.
If Earth is at the bottom, all solid, God is at the top, completely abstract. The dream worlds are somewhere in the middle. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Causal bodies and so on. Dreams. Mm-hmm. Dreams are somewhere in the middle. Things are only half formed. Okay.
Right.
And so you can, with greater consciousness in dreams, you can literally create the thing in front of you. You can go from one place to another very easily. I've never visited other planets in lucid dreaming. I went through a phase of lucid dreaming, which stopped after a while. But I do mm-hmm. know people who, you know, they don't follow any structured mystical path, but they do lucid dream. And they do come back with remarkable tales of which they mm-hmm. were powerfully affected emotionally of, you know, visiting, seeing other beings and visiting other planets and so
right.
forth.
Right, yeah.
It's amazing, really. And,
I don't think there's any limits. I think that if you intend to visit another place, I mean, I remember walking around in places with giant mushroom trees and different colors and different plants that I've never seen before. I mean, I was obviously on a different planet. I had to be.
Right. Yeah.
But, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I think it's possible. But in the dream state, you're right. I mean, in a dream state, things shift very quickly. You can, if you're in a tight situation, you can flip it and then get out of it. You know, you don't have to you know, you don't have to suffer there for a long time. You know, like you can decide to do something else. You decide to wake up, you know, and then go,
right.
God, I'm glad that was a dream. You know, I don't really want to live there. Yeah, you know, if you're stuck in a place or something, you know, you're in a small hole and can't get out, you can just wake up, you know.
Yeah,
but
sure.
I sort of think it's like that when we die. I think we wake up and I go, my God, I can't believe I went through that. You know, it's like I should have been able to do better than that.
I think
we wake up from this life like we wake up from a dream.
Yeah, that's true. So getting back to atheism, I want to say you can take pretty much any atheist
mm-hmm.
with enough information from modern physics, convince him or her that of the existence of an underlying interconnectedness with string theory and what have you. But
mm-hmm.
at that point, you've got him believing in like the impersonal aspect of God. He just doesn't
mm-hmm.
know it yet. Okay, the personal,
right. yeah.
The personal devotional aspect is more difficult, but a reasonable atheist can be convinced. Like, what's the thing that he or she loves and finds most meaningful for most people?
Mm-hmm.
What won't that be? You tell me. Most people out there, the most meaningful thing in their lives is what?
Family.
Right. Their kids, typically.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
yeah.
Where do those things come from? Where do these beautiful, young, intelligent creatures come from? You love them. Well, by extension, you also love the thing that they came out of, right?
Right.
And what is that thing? And the answer to that, of course, is hopelessly complex and manifold, but so it leads you back to this great mystery, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the third step is like to get them to realize that the thing that they don't believe in is completely inaccurate to begin with. So God isn't this giant fatherly thing up in the sky who create good and evil. No, that's the Sunday school version.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're right in having misgivings about the parental function that God has for a lot of people. Even most people in Orthodox organized religion, but that's not the real thing, right? That's a Freudian God.
Right.
So that's the deity that we're in the process of growing out of. And that's why more young people than ever are unchurched, as they say, and why, you know, people are going through a major period of confusion in society. It's gonna increase. Okay. And I think that confusion is actually an expression of longing. Someone
mm-hmm.
who's really looking, who doesn't have any connection with spirituality or religion, doesn't really know what he's looking for, but is agonizingly looking, searching for something, that's longing. That's like a low burn longing for God, and that's where a lot of people are at these days, I think.
Well, you know, one of the biggest things that that separates spiritually based people from the non-spiritually based, be they agnostic or atheist, is the fear of death. I mean, that's the big, according to Deepak Chopra, I was interviewing him on my radio show, and I was interviewing him on How to Know God, which is a great book, and I said, Deepak, what are you going to write next? And he said, well, the biggest question for people is, you know, what happens when I die? Because they fear death without spirituality. Most spiritually based people look forward to death. They really think that it's going to just be a natural transition and it's going to be a lot better for them. So when you look at somebody who's like stuck in the third dimension, can't really imagine dimensions outside of this, and therefore because God isn't in this third dimension, they're not sure that God exists. And then when you go out of the third dimension, if you don't believe in anything else, you cease to exist logically. And that's got to be scary.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the whole thing with what they call the long, lonely leap. I mean, I do think that a lot of, you know, a lot of people in Orthodox religion, and at the conscious level, sure, they're not afraid because they're going to go to heaven and so forth. But subconsciously,
mm-hmm.
where they really, really know, I mean, at deeper levels, I do think that, you know, people have deeper, profound knowledge about things, which they're not ready
mm-hmm.
to understand consciously.
Right.
A lot of folks in Orthodox religion are subconsciously scared to death of dying.
Right. Because they think they're going to be annihilated.
Right.
And the ego, I mean, I really don't even think the ego is totally annihilated, because the mediums can bring back the personalities at any time, and you know, and talk to them. So I think like Gary Schwartz writes a book about this, that you know, we continue in frequency forever. Okay, he came to that realization. It's kind of a neat book. That, you know, our frequency, if we're a frequency, then our frequency is always going to be in the universe. And, if you believe in the Akashic records, then all, you know, it's always there. But basically the whole thing comes down to, if you don't believe in anything beyond the third dimension, you're going to assume that once you die, you're just snuffed out.
That's the very good technical way of putting it. Most people get around that through, you know, devotional understanding, just this profound realization that there is something more, even if they know nothing about a fourth or fifth dimension. Yeah, that's very true, I think.
And then all these people who have near-death experiences, tremendously transformed by that experience, because they realize that the third dimension is illusionary, you know, that's not all there is. By direct experience. So
yeah,
the majority of people, there are some negative near-death experiences that I think are meant to get people back on track, but
sure.
Most of the positive near-death experiences, their fear of death totally disappears.
Yeah, absolutely. It completely goes. I think it's important for folks to understand that the mystical path, your ego doesn't get destroyed. It gets transformed. Okay.
Right.
So, you start out on the spiritual path as a loudmouth New Yorker on the mystical path. You'll remain a loudmouth New Yorker after self-realization.
Right.
So your ego does not get destroyed. It gets transformed. For me, one of the most difficult and profound things to understand about that whole process, the final leap, the final breakthrough to the goal, if you will, is that it doesn't happen to you. It does not happen to the individual.
Mm-hmm.
The individual is, annihilated into God. And the most frightening thing about it is that you do, in a sense, lose your identity completely, totally and absolutely. But, of course, you stay the same person. You remain the same person. You will change subtly. But the actual experience involves complete and total loss, annihilation into the ultimate greatness of all there is, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to die in this life to get there. That's what I find both frightening and alluring at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you really have to be.
Really what you're trading, I mean, if you're in the atheist agnostic world and you probably either consciously or subconsciously fear death because there's, you know, I mean, you can't conceive of anything beyond death. I think that the living with that kind of fear is really crippling.
Well, you know, there are two kinds of atheists, roughly speaking.
Mm-hmm.
There's the angry, bitter types who've been burned by life and who, for that reason, often dwell on negative things and so forth and can't see enough good in the world to fathom an overall creator at some dimension. But you do have these very gentle-minded atheists who, you know, understand God to be a sort of useful metaphor for people, which people use to relate to the universe with.
Mm-hmm.
And those individuals, you know, they have a very, I think it's possible to have a spirituality without the notion of God, but with a general sense of overall cosmic process, an overall sense of unity awareness, with kind of all that is, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's a word somewhere in their consciousness for God. So you know, it's like the Great Spirit in Native American thought. That's a very almost pantheistic idea.
Right.
It almost isn't God at all. It's sort of a notion of this great universal energy that sort of runs through everything. But the consciousness of the notion of God isn't really in their vocabulary. But that doesn't mean that the feeling isn't there.
Right.
They understand it, but they just don't have a word for it.
But I think
we're just creative force, you know. Like, you know, some of the spiritual literature that the masters have given us, you know, there's this great thing of the void that all creation came out of. So you have this void, which is, you know, the creative force. The universe is all the multi-universes, and there's probably more than one, the multiverse theory, come out of this void.
Great effulgent void, yes.
Yeah, I mean, that it's just a creative force, that and that we're part of that creative force, and we can create just, you know, we are an extension of that, so we can create, and then we get to experience what we create.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting form of it.
You know, in all, we create the universe, and in all the mystical philosophy, in all the mystical mm-hmm. branches of the religions, there are some philosophers in each one of those mystical branches who write emanation theories, you know, which is mm-hmm. the notion of the universe coming down from God in stages, you know.
Stages dimensionally, God. And it's dimensionally right.
Absolutely, and then
so
there's hierarchy. Yeah. You travel the same thing backwards in all the great
back
hierarchy.
Up to ascension, right? Yeah,
exactly. It's the same thing. Yeah. The emanation theory back mm-hmm. down, and their hierarchy yeah. back up.
Right.
Whichever hierarchy you're into.
Right.
So yeah, that's a very, very profound aspect of reality, which people need to understand. And in fact, I just got a book written by a friend of yours. It is magisterial. It's an unbelievable book. You know,
yeah.
And it's, oh my God, I just can't get over it. I'm learning so much about reading it. She has to talk about a lot of basic stuff, but it's still really cool. So this, I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm a Zen guy. I basically just go for the gold, prefer the great effulgent mm-hmm. void, all the angels and levels. Dissolve for me,
right?
Into the
go directly into the creative source.
but I still have a huge intellectual interest in this stuff as a scholar, and
yeah.
I'm doing a lot of very, very profound and enjoyable reading.
There was a movie that came out a few years ago that had a profound effect on a lot of atheists, and that was The Matrix.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the idea of the Matrix is it's an interesting metaphor. And some of the spiritual teachings teach us that the third dimension is a construct. It's an illusion. It's something artificial that we project ourselves into in order to learn certain lessons, you know, create time so that everything's not happening at once. And, you know, we can't really imagine what it's like outside this dimension while we're in it, but that this is not real. This is illusionary. The Course in Miracles talks about that. And I find it just a useful way to look at things.
It's a very useful metaphor because
it is.
There is a large degree of truth to it. Scientifically, in terms of modern physics and so forth, and frequencies and so forth, reality
mm-hmm.
is understood as a matrix, right? And there are
subtlety
in reality and everything. And so it's all very scientific and powerful, and you eventually realize indirectly that there is some great unifying whole to all of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then
right.
the knowledge, that profound knowledge, crosses over into devotional experience,
right?
Into a real sense of love and joy, mm-hmm. and profound gratitude for life. So
right.
all of your science, all of your knowledge, all of your great mathematical wizardry and special effects ends up making you realize that there is something out there. There is this great, huge, vast, profound thing which accounts for everything. And you
mm-hmm.
are it. You know?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and
yeah.
So...
But waking up from the Matrix, that really is something people should meditate on, I think, you know. We live in the Matrix. It seems to be controlled at a higher level that isn't necessarily good. You know, the powers that be, the dark forces controlling everything, the economy, this, that, and the other, the food sources, medicine, and then yet this is not real. I mean, this is the matrix that we're in.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. It's a beautiful way of getting people to understand the really profound aspect of reality, which we're always trying to deal with.
Right.
So, yeah, when you reject these superficial teachings, connect with the churches, connect with Orthodox religion, you're forced to start groping around for something more permanent.
Mm-hmm.
Even if most people don't seem to be interested, they are involuntarily. If you're mm-hmm. human, on some level, you become an involuntary mystical seeker. Once you find yourself getting sick of Orthodox spirituality, you must cast your luck into the unknown and begin really searching.
Right. So a lot of people tell me, and I'm sure they tell you, that they would like to meditate, but they can't slow their thinking down. You know, it's frustrating for them because they try to meditate, but it's just like not happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's, you know, it is something that is a common problem.
They're defining meditation too narrowly. There uh-huh. are movement techniques. There mm-hmm. are, you can do walking meditation. You can do, mm-hmm. You can do yoga posture meditation.
Right.
Breathing movement. There are lots of different, I would say, you know, Tai Chi and Qigong
right.
and Hatha yoga sequences are where
mm-hmm.
you start with that. You know,
right.
if you can't meditate sitting down with your eyes closed, you can meditate doing contemplative movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that would be the major thing people need to realize about meditation. Don't define it so narrowly, you know.
I think that's why businessmen play golf.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, and and challenge yourself not to do it to music. I mean, that's the whole
mm-hmm.
point of meditation is to have inner silence. So,
right, yeah.
If you do a jazzercise yoga routine to music, slow it down and do it in silence. But
mm-hmm.
still, get up there and do, you know, actually do your physical movement. That's the meditation. That's where you need to start. If you can't sit still for 20 minutes with your eyes closed without going crazy, then
right.
a movement technique. That's where you start.
Yeah. And, you know, the sports figures that say when they're in the zone,
yeah.
or piano players are in the zone, or in surgery, we get in the zone. And if I'm in the zone in surgery, I don't even hear people talking to me. It's weird. You know, if somebody comes in the room, I don't even hear them. I'm so focused on what I'm doing in surgery.
Yeah.
So, you know, being in the zone is really whatever you're doing. If you're in the zone, you really are merged with something beyond yourself, and time, just there's no passing of time. I mean, it's just,
sometimes
you're just there. Yeah.
I find myself getting in the zone most when I'm lecturing, and I really get on
mm-hmm.
a roll, and the words just pour out, you know, and I don't
right.
really know why I'm saying what I'm saying, but
mm-hmm.
but what I'm saying is having a powerful impact on the students.
Right, right.
And that's why.
Well, you're totally connected to whatever is coming in through you, and it's just a flow, and it's effortless. You know, it's just there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're coming up on the end of our hour. Would you like to give your contact information one more time?
Sure. David@worldspirituality.com is the email. David Lowe, L-O-W, no E, David Lowe, MS as in Masters of Science, MSPhD.com is the website. David Lowe, MSPhD.com. David@worldspirituality.com is an easy email
mm-hmm.
address to remember. I give free sessions. Your first DreamWorks session is free, either by phone or Skype or written, plus phone and Skype. So
mm-hmm.
that is offered to anyone who has a dream they're trying to fathom, especially if it's a complex dream, repetitive
mm-hmm.
dream, a little bit unpleasant, and there's a lot of turmoil in your life.
It could be
really important.
Yeah, and the dream state, too, is presenting probably presenting things to you in a way that you can ignore. You know, you can just like just don't do dream work at all. But if you decide to do dream work, then you're going to be advancing spiritually and you'll be advancing toward solving some of the problems that you may have, you know, not been able to solve before in your life. So
and dreams,
it is worthwhile work. It really is.
Dreams are the most evident and obvious means we all have inherently to communicate with higher reality. I mean, so the way to understand it is, you know, the way we live our lives, the things we say, the things we do, the way we live our lives, all of that asks a question of the universe in some sense.
Right.
And dreams are just part of the way the universe reacts back to us.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, dreams have important psychobiological functions. People, if they're not allowed to dream, but they still get enough sleep, they will stop functioning after a couple of weeks completely. You get things depressed forever, basically, unless you start dreaming again. But they also have spiritual functions. They are the natural higher dimension of who we are. And the reason we, you know, sleep is still a mystery to science, basically. And the reason it's a mystery is because they're studying it empirically. Sleep happens because the higher dimensions of our being also need their own cycle of activity, just like our physical body does. You know, so we go to sleep, we do stuff in the astral. And so that's part of our being, just like our physical body is. That's why we sleep.
Right.
I think that's why we sleep. You know, maybe.
Yeah. Well, we're coming up to the end of the hour. We've been interviewing Dr. David Lowe, The Growing Atheist Orientation in Modern Society. Next week, we'll be interviewing Dr. Jill Carnahan, Mold Biotoxins, and I guess you can join us next week. Thanks for joining us, David.
Thank you, Susan. It's been wonderful. Take care.
Great.